the Miller Center, we've hoped for some months that Ambassador Campbell might join us, because in each area he's had a unique part in the history which has been made, and a successful history, one might add. One is the arms control area, and the other is the Reagan oral history effort which the Miller Center has made. Ambassador Campbellman has had a rich background in various fields, in education, beginning with a bachelor's degree and a JD degree from NYU, and a master's and a PhD from University of Minnesota. He's taught political science at University of Minnesota, Harvard, Claremont, Bennington. He was, I think, once, weren't you, Secretary Treasurer of the American Political Science Association, as I remember.
Treasurer for a long time.
Right. So, in the field of education and in both government, with the Davids and with others around this room, and in law, he's played a very central role as a partner for decades in Freed, Frank, Harris, Shriver, and Campbellman, his partner of that firm. He was a senior advisor to the U.S. delegation to the U.N. 1966 to 1967, and then had a whole series of appointments in the Reagan administration. I'll mention them quickly. Ambassador and chairman of the U.S. delegation to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, meeting in Madrid, 1980-83, ambassador and head of the U.S. delegation to negotiations on nuclear and space arms, 1985-89, counselor of the Department of State. He's the author of the Communist Party against the and the CIO, the Strategy of Deception, and three years at the East-West Divide. He was a moderator of the Washington Week in Review. He's co-chairman also of the U.S. delegation to observe the elections in Salvador. One could go on even more offensively than I have with this recitation.
Don't do that.
So we're terribly pleased that he has, in a very busy schedule, joined us, and he will tell us something about both our subjects. And you may ask questions, both the arms control and the Reagan history subject. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It seems to me, as Ken and I have been talking on the way over here from my hotel, that you do have the Reagan Project, and I'll be very happy to cover that and answer any questions you may have about that. You do have a keen interest in the arms issue, which we can talk about as well. And then in general, I suppose the overall direction of the Soviet Union, and at least the extent to which I have interrelated with it, what observations we might share about that, I think could also cover it. I don't have any clear idea as to how long I should speak before I throw it open to questions, so let's just see how it evolves. And maybe what we should do is, if you have questions as I say something, just interrupt me. That's a way to get the discussion started. I should say that in the appointment that I had to Madrid, which was 1980, was an appointment made by President Carter. Then I was reappointed by President Reagan. And then President Reagan did get me involved in the arms issue. I had experience with the American Communist Movement many years ago as a youngster. I had worked with some of the trade unions actually, I worked my way through school and got involved in trade unions that way. The Garment Workers Union in New York. And those unions, you may know, had a rather intensive conflict going on with the effort of the Communist Party to take over the trade union movement in America. And the Garment Workers Union was in the forefront of those unions resisting the efforts of the Communist Party to take over the unions. And I found myself as a student getting therefore somewhat involved in that effort. And that interested me very much. I observed it. And then as a law student, and I went to Knight Law School, I found myself, because I'd been active somehow in the Garment Workers Union, I found myself dragged into a conflict taking place within the American law student group, with the communists making an effort to capture that group. And students, knowing I had some experience, getting me involved in that too. So I had that exposure also. As I continued with graduate work at the University of Minnesota, all of this kind of merged together. And in 1946, and I got active in politics as a political scientist, the political science department at the University of Minnesota was a department that got active in politics in the state. Interesting. Hubert Humphrey, for example, was a product of that experience in the from the political science department. And in 1946, we found ourselves with the Democratic Farmer Labor Party captured by what we thought was the communist wing. The communist movement was very active in Minnesota. They controlled the CIO in Minnesota in 1946. I go into this because one of the questions always in my mind has been the differences that might exist between, let's say, how American communists might act and how Soviet communists might act. I've been struck by that on occasion. Not that I'm prepared to write a book on the subject or arrive at any specific conclusions about the subject, but it has interested me. Certain similarities of pattern have interested me as I've observed them in these experiences over the years. For example, one way that I found the American communist movement was able to gain great influence within the American labor movement, and it did, and that was the book that Kent talked about that I did write, was my doctoral dissertation, was a readiness to be patient and to stay at the meetings on into the night while other folk got tired and decided to go home and go to bed. And I found that to be a pattern in dealing with the Soviets as well, which is an interesting commentary here. And now maybe I can move into the process of negotiating with the Soviets, which fits in to this pattern. If there is a book in Moscow called How to Negotiate with the Americans, maybe How to Negotiate with the West, I would think that a first principle in that book would be wait them out. And there are reasons for this that are fascinating reasons. We are subject of the West. We are subject to certain rules of internal regulation that the Soviets have not traditionally been subject to. Well, let me illustrate it this way. In Madrid, toward the end of our meeting, the head of their delegation at that time was a deputy foreign minister by the name of Ilyichev. He was then about 76. I remember his 75th birthday happened on a weekend, and he got a call from Brezhnev. And first thing Monday morning is he told me about this wonderful call he'd gotten from Brezhnev. He was very proud of it. He was a man who used to be the editor of Pravda, man of some influence in the Soviet system, although by then, not in the mainstream, but still a deputy foreign minister. Well, anyhow, this man, we were moving finally in Madrid, and this man asked to have a cup of coffee with me. He spoke no English at all, but we had an interpreter. And he said he'd been reviewing the history of our negotiations in Madrid. And he said that he was struck again by the fact that the Soviets had made all the concessions and the Americans had not made concessions. And he thought that was unfair. That is no way to run a negotiation. Well, I responded by acknowledging the accuracy of what he said. The fact of the matter is, they did make most of the concessions, and we made very few in that area. But I said, I want to explain this to you, Mr. Minister. And this goes to the point of the first rule of the communist negotiating pattern. I said, let's assume for a moment that you want to end up here. I had a table in front of you. You want to end up here. There's nothing to prevent you from starting off here. Now let's assume we want to end up here in the negotiations. Now you might think, well, why don't we start at that end of the table? I said, we can't. We can't because in my country, for us to arrive at a position, it has to appear reasonable to the American society. If we come in with an unreasonable position, we're hurt. Now, the definition of reasonableness is one that depends on what the Congress thinks is reasonable, what the various agencies of the executive branch think is reasonable, what the American press thinks is reasonable, what the opposing political party thinks is reasonable. Because if you don't meet those criteria, you get criticized. So there's an internal pressure that prevents me from starting way out there. I got to start someplace here. You're starting there, and then you come into this negotiation and you say, let's meet halfway. Well, I said, well, you're going to meet over here? I can't do that. I can't do that. That's not the way we will negotiate with you. So the only way we can have any kind of an agreement with you is if you make the concessions. Because I said, it isn't even enough for us to have to start here because of American pressures. Once we arrive at a position, we then have to take it up with our NATO allies. And they have their own ideas to what's reasonable. So instead of maybe starting here, we got to keep moving this way a little bit. And I said, that's the reality of dealing with us. And if you want an agreement with us, you have to understand that. Well, the fact of the matter is, the pattern of our relationships with them has put us on the defensive for years because of their argument, we'll be halfway. And we then appear unreasonable if we don't want to meet them halfway. Now, given their knowledge that pressures are always on us, from our publics, from the opposing political party, from our allies, from the press, they operate on the assumption they wait. And if they wait, internal pressures will lead us to move. Because obviously, if there is no agreement, it must be our fault. And I've run into this in these arms negotiations constantly. If there is no agreement, it's our fault. There's also a cultural pattern. I used to teach at Bennington, and there was a very capable anthropologist there. His name is Edward Hall. Some of you may know his one particularly good book of his called The Silent Language. He's a cultural anthropologist. He then moved to Washington, and the State Department used him. And he used to say that our culture was such that we like to fill the voids. If we're talking, two people talking to each other, and there's a silence, somehow there's a need to fill that silence by saying something. Soviets don't have that need. Now, what are you going to say? Well, maybe you ought to make a concession. Or maybe you say something that gives them some kind of insight about your position. Again, all of this supporting the view that it, the first rule that I feel, wait, the West will make concessions and you won't have to pay for them. And that's something we have to keep in mind very much. And I suppose, given the fact that I had some experience in this area, that I'd worked with them, that I taught problems of democracy, I taught Marxism and Leninism a little bit, I simply didn't play that game. And I think it's essential that we not play that game. But I want to indicate that's really one of the important aspects. I remember my wife came to Madrid at one point, early on, I was there for the first part of it, alone, because she wasn't feeling too well, and then she joined me. And she happened to arrive at a day in which we were invited by the Spanish to visit the Duke of Alba's home, where there were magnificent works of art. And so Maggie came with me, and we went looking through those works of art, and that same Ilyuchev was there, and I introduced Ilyuchev. She had just arrived that day. And I went off looking at some paintings, and I didn't realize Maggie and he were continuing to talk. He was a little fella, and I could hear his shouting back there, and he's pulling Maggie by the hand over to me and saying something in Russian, which then get translated and say, see, she too says you're a stubborn man. But you know, that I say this because I think it is a characteristic that we must be willing to deal with. The Soviets are extraordinary. Soviet negotiators I have met with are extraordinarily capable people. They're experts in their field. They stay with the subject matter for many years. Our people tend to get rotated around. These people stay with the subject matter for a long period of time. This becomes their career. That subject matter becomes their career. They also have a great deal more at stake individually than Americans have. So I get fired. Maybe some university will hire me. If I got fired, some people who got fired became heroes after getting fired. Universities out to grab them. But you know, a Soviet negotiator is in a privileged position. Where they live, whether they have to stay online for food, the kind of food they can buy and clothing, education for their children, medical facilities for the family, careers, tremendous amount of nepotism in the Soviet society. This all depends on their remaining in good favor. And the best way not to get hurt is simply not to be too creative, but to be steadfast and to follow instructions. So they have a great deal at stake at being considered loyal, capable, successful people. And we don't really have quite the same inhibitions. most Americans as we go through our that kind of business, which gives us a little bit more flexibility. I think gives us a little bit more creativity in moving, gives us a little bit more use of imagination to find ways around this. This also accounts for slow reactions, traditionally slow reactions by the Soviets. And I learned a long time ago that the niet is not necessarily a no. It's an immediate no. It's the safest thing to say to a new idea is no. But they take it. They cable it back to Moscow. Moscow goes through these issues very, very thoroughly. And you never know when something will come out of that. When you don't expect it, you may get an answer to something you've proposed down the road, because they've studied it. It'll take a long time. On one issue, for example, for those of you who are familiar more with the arms control technicalities, I remember one issue involving in the space areas free zones for testing. They were in Washington, and I was sitting next to my Soviet counterpart, a man by the name of Karpov. And we were beginning to play around with an idea in Washington, which had been advanced to us by some scientists, not in the government. We were beginning to play around with an idea. And I remember talking to the scientists, and I got the feeling that our scientists had talked to some Soviet scientists about this. I didn't know whether it was an official talk or unofficial talk, so I was sitting next to Karpov, and I said, "Victor, I got a question to ask you now. Our scientists are urging upon us ABC, and I want to know whether we ought to put any time into that. They got it from one of your scientists. Was your scientist speaking for the government, or was he just speaking for himself?" So he said, "Well, you got to remember this is now after 2 years of negotiating and pretty good rapport." And he said, "You better tell me what the idea is. I'm not familiar with it." So I told him as best I could. I am not a scientist. I must say to you, I am not an arms control expert, although I've learned a great deal about arms. I think I am an expert on the negotiating process, and I know the Soviets quite well. So I explained the idea as best I could. He asked a lot of questions about it. We discussed it. Shortly after lunch, Schultz and Shevardnadze were meeting in Schultz's office, and within a few minutes, we were supposed to join them, Karpov and I, and we joined them. I remember Shevardnadze turns to both of us and said, "What, how have you two fellows been doing this morning?" And I said, "Not too well." And then Karpov said, "Well, we're exploring something that I don't fully understand yet." So I threw something. I told Shevardnadze he hadn't heard of it before. I'm convinced of it. And so he and Schultz said, "Well, follow it through." Well, this is now, I think, a year and a half, 2 years. We don't have a response from the Soviets yet on the subject. Every once in a while, I get a question about it. We've now had lots of discussions about it. I'm now out of the process, but by now we've had lots of discussions about it. They're skeptical about it, they're unsure of it, they're a little suspicious of it, they don't quite want to say no yet. It's interesting how long it's just taken. I'm sure they're thoroughly exploring it, but it's an idea of how careful they are in many of the details of what they do. It's just an illustration, really. This process. Now, another thought of illustration of this, and I suppose something that's part of the negotiating process, an integral part of the negotiating process, and that's to keep your ears open and your antenna up. We began our negotiations in arms negotiations in March of 1985. I want to say to you that in March of 1985, Chernenko died. Gorbachev came in to office. Chernenko died, I think it was a day before our negotiations were to begin. Formal negotiations were to begin. I really, as of that point, had not met any of the Soviets. We hadn't been introduced, and I had not been involved in INF earlier or in START earlier, so I didn't know these people. But with the death of Chernenko, I had my people call him on the telephone and say, I'm not a Russian speaker, but I have a lot of Russian speakers around, and say to the Soviets that we've noted Chernenko's death, and if the Soviets would like to postpone the opening of talks, we have no problem with that. And if they want to go back to Moscow for the funeral, I didn't know what their pattern was, want to go back, or if they simply wanted to observe the day, that's fine as far as we were concerned. And the response was a rather immediate one, saying, no, no, negotiations will start as scheduled. And they added, and the morning book would be open for signatures at the Soviet mission. So that's where we started. Now, I will say that within a day or two, they let me know that Gorbachev had reviewed all their instructions, even while Chernenko was alive. We now have learned that probably is correct. That is, probably Gorbachev was acting as the head even while Chernenko was in office, because Chernenko was ill. So I imagine they didn't lie to me when they said that to me. But this was their way of saying, we speak with authority. We have our government, this change. But nevertheless, the change did mean that in addition to wait him out, which is their rule, I think they were floundering for about a year, the Soviets, not knowing where they were. You have to remember, within a few months thereafter, their foreign minister disappeared into the presidency. And a new foreign minister came on the scene, Shevardnadze. The day Shevardnadze's name was announced as the foreign minister and Gromyko promoted, we had some senators in Geneva. And I had invited the Soviets to meet these senators at a reception. So obviously, when the Soviets came in, the first question I and others asked them is, what do you know about Shevardnadze and who is he? And it was very clear to me that none of them, and these were senior people, had ever met Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze was a member of the Politburo, but he had no exposure to international relations. This was not his field. So they didn't know anything about him. You could see how, within that kind of a society, the safest thing to do is to be paralyzed and not to act. And that's the way it was for about the first year. Nevertheless, one of the Soviets, a man by the name of Kvitsinsky, who participated with Paul Nitze in the Walk in the Woods, was present then. He is now their ambassador to Bonn. I had two counterparts. I had Karpov, who was my counterpart as the head of the negotiating team, because I was the head and he was the head of his. I also had a specific responsibility in space, SDI. And the man handling space for the Soviets was Kvitsinsky. And I had lunch with Kvitsinsky early on. We opened in March. This must have been in June or July. Now, Kvitsinsky, who took the Walk in the Woods with Paul, is really the only creative fellow that I have run into in the traditional Soviet bureaucracy, and he got hurt for his walk in the woods with Paul. But he was a kind of, was a little bit of a freewheeler. And I remember at lunch saying to him, "Yuli, I saw that Gorbachev wrote a letter to the Union of Concerned Scientists in America. I don't understand the letter." And he said, "Well, it's a clear letter. I don't know why you don't understand it." I said, "Well, because he has a reference in there to reaffirming the ABM treaty." I said, "I don't know your system, but we don't know how to reaffirm treaties, but you obviously reaffirm treaties. When you reaffirm a treaty, does that treaty have greater validity than a treaty you did not reaffirm?" He began looking at me skeptically. And I said, "Do you reaffirm treaties more than once?" And by then he said, "Stop pulling my leg." He knew English well, and he knew the idioms of the English. And he said, "Stop pulling my leg." And I said, "I really don't understand this." So he said, "Well, you know what we want. We want to be certain that as we go ahead and reduce arms with you, if we can come to an agreement, that you do not suddenly put up an ABM system into space. Now, we want to make sure you're not going to withdraw from the ABM treaty. So that's why we're asking you to reaffirm it and tell us you're not going to withdraw from it." So I said, "Well, the treaty itself says we will not withdraw. It's a perpetual treaty." He says, "Yeah, but you have a right to give 6 months' notice and withdraw." And I said, "Yes, is that not enough time for you?" He says, "No, it's not enough time for us." I said, "How much time do you want to make certain that we are not going to withdraw within that period?" He said, "At least 10 years. Well, let me say that that's the first indication I got as to where they're heading. Or at least where he thought they ought to be heading. You have to remember, up until then, and I will say for the following 12 months, all they talked about was they do not want to militarize space. They do not want to put a military system in space. That was their slogan. I used to say to them, "Get off that. That's a slogan, not a negotiating position. When you're ready to negotiate, give me a negotiating position, then I can talk to you about it." Well, this was a negotiating position. And I cabled back immediately to Washington and I said, "That's where they're heading." I had discounted, frankly, the 10 years to maybe 7 or 8 years in my own head. But Kuczynski said to me, "How does that sound to you?" And I said, "Well, Yuli, it sounds much better than the slogans you've been giving me, because I can understand that." I said, "Let me think about that, but I'd encourage you, you have to come up with a more realistic period, but I would encourage you to think." Now, of course, in my head, I knew very well that the SDI would take quite a few years before we were ready to deploy it. So I did not feel we would be hurt by a commitment of time. Just to say to you, it took until the following June, by then Kvitsinsky was in Bonn. Following June, again at a lunch, but with Karpov this time, who took over space, SDI. He said, "Tomorrow, Max, I'm coming in with a new position." And I said, "What's your position?" "We're going to make a commitment for both of us not to withdraw from the ABM treaty for a period of time," which is what I had gotten a year earlier. And I said, "I'm glad to hear that, because I haven't taken anything you've said seriously in this area." And I said, "How long?" He said, "20 years. Well, the 20 years moved to within a very quick order of time, 15 to 20 years. Then I got a position saying up to 15 years, which was a strange position, up to 15 years. And then at Iceland in Reykjavik, Gorbachev came up with the 10 years that I'd gotten a lot earlier. In the meantime, Reagan had written a letter to Gorbachev in which he had talked about 6 or 7 years. So we were, you see, in an area of negotiating on this point. Well, I don't want to keep rambling, Ken. Why don't we stop here and just throw it open to questions?
Okay. Who'd like to ask the first question? Was Reykjavik as much of a disaster as Henry Kissinger claims it was?
It was both a disaster and a breakthrough. It was both. The disaster, in quotation marks, was the realization that Ronald Reagan was prepared to go down to zero on all nuclear weapons. And this was a shocker to our European friends and to many Americans. And we still have experienced some problems with our European friends on that realization. I want to add a word about that. Ronald Reagan is opposed to nuclear weapons. I mean, this was not something frivolous. This was not something he hadn't thought about. This was not something he got tricked into. Fact of the matter is, he wants to go down to zero on nuclear weapons. And I can tell you for a fact that I don't know a single one of his advisors who agrees with him when he was president, who agreed with him. Not a single one agreed with him. And I was present at meetings where rather polite issue was taken with him in his presence. And he never budged on it. And let me give you one response that I heard him give, which I thought was quite effective. I don't agree with him on the nuclear weapons going down to zero now. Certainly not now. I suppose if all weapons were reduced to infinitesimal proportions, it's perfectly good for nuclear weapons to go down to zero. But I remember him saying, the Soviets had Chernobyl. We could have Chernobyl. Let's assume the next Chernobyl is not power plants, but nuclear weapon plants. And it's in the United States. Public opinion in the United States and public opinion throughout the West will lead us to get rid of these nuclear weapons. Just like in the power area, we are at the point now where you cannot really, except in France, put up a nuclear power plant and get away with it, given public opinion. Look what's happening to the American industry. Now he said, at that point, it'll be unilateral disarmament. We'll be the ones, the West will be the ones, the public opinion will press to get rid of the nuclear weapons. The Soviets will not be restrained by that, given the fact they're increasing their nuclear energy in the power field. They're increasing while Europe is decreasing it. So he said, let's do this through negotiation instead of doing it by the inevitable accident requiring us to do it. That was an argument, which I must say to you, I had not thought of before and had some appeal to it. But that was the negative part of Reykjavik. On the other hand, I will say to you that the breakthroughs in many areas were very significant. breakthroughs in INF, the breakthroughs in START took place there. Lots of agreements, not finalized or formalized, because we ended up without an agreement at the end. And I think both parties, both Gorbachev and Reagan, though they left very, very irritated with one another, personally irritated with one another, as both thought about it, both appreciated that a great deal had been done. And both then began to talk about the pluses that came out of Reykjavik.
May I ask a question, Ken? Yeah,
sure.
Let me get into your favorite area of human rights, Max. I, like you, I was drawn unwillingly into the frustration of negotiations with the Soviets, only for 3 years, whereas you put in about eight. It happened to be with the Geneva Conventions, human rights, and so on. The Soviets will not negotiate unless you give them an incentive, a point you made very succinctly last night. In this case, they refused to meet with the American delegation. Basil O'Connor was our ambassador. They wouldn't meet in Prague. They wouldn't meet in the United States or anywhere until we got to an International Red Cross Convention in Stockholm, with Count Bernadotte presiding, and a full delegation showed up. First time that they had ever deigned to meet with the American delegation. And we thought, oh boy, now at last we're going to negotiate with them. First day, the leader got up, said, we will not take part in any negotiation where the representatives of fascist Spain are present. They sat for 7 weeks up in the balcony. We used to call them the seven blocks of granite, listening to the proposals. Next year, a diplomatic convention in Geneva, representatives of fascist Spain took present, full delegation showed up and did their best to sabotage the conventions. But eventually, what was the incentive? 81 nations signed in Stockholm. And they said, well, now we gotta go. All right, that's the background. Now comes Afghanistan, and this leads me to my question. There's no question but what the Soviets violated the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan. The Najibullah government and the COD, which is the KGB, gave none of the rights which are guaranteed by the Geneva Conventions. My question to you, sir, is what should the United States be doing to publicize the violations of the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan or anywhere else?
I personally believe that whenever there are violations of an agreement, one has to publicize them. One has to dramatize them. One has to protest them energetically. I deeply regret the fact that we did not do so when Iraq went ahead and used poison chemicals. We were just pro forma about it. We were pro forma about it primarily because we didn't want Iran to win the war, and so we kind of quietly encouraged the Iraq. I think that was a serious mistake. I don't know. I hope we don't, but we may have to pay serious prices for that mistake. I think you have to call a spade when there's a violation of a treaty. Now, after you call a spade, that's rhetoric. You then have to decide what do you want to do about it, besides what you want to say about it. And what you want to do about it is really always an ad hoc decision, based on weighing pros and cons of what's in your interest to do. I don't know, for example, that these blanket formulae, impose sanctions, boycott, are the kinds of formulae one must automatically impose. Yes, you may want to. You may make an independent judgment, weigh the pros, weigh the cons, decide to do this. There are times you may want to say, okay, let's take not the Geneva Conventions on the rules of war, but let's take the Helsinki Accords in human rights, which is what you asked about, where clearly the Soviets violated it, beginning with the month after they signed it in 1975. They signed it, very soon thereafter they took Helsinki monitors and began to put them in jail. Now, you could say, as I indicated last night to the students I met with, you could say, as Ronald Reagan said in the campaign of 1980, we're not sending our athletes to Moscow, why should we send our diplomats to Madrid? And therefore, not attend the next meeting on human rights with the Soviets on the ground, you'd be dignifying. You could say that. I didn't agree with that. My view was, and our government's view was, we go there and use that forum to attack some more, instead of abandoning the opportunity to attack and to criticize in public fora. But you've got to make individual judgments about it. And I don't know, Bill, anything else that I know how to answer this question. The business of sanctions and boycotts is, in a sense, purifying to the soul. It's a nice thing to do. But you have to ask yourself whether it's an effective thing to do. Sometimes it may be. I feel, for example, our boycott of the Moscow Olympics was effective. It hurt them no end. But that had a particular advantage to it. Namely, there were dates to that boycott. The Olympics began on day one and ended on day X. And so you were over. But if you have one of these endless things, then you boycott or you impose a sanction, you can do it forever. You then have to end it. When you end it, are you then putting a seal of approval? It's really a very difficult thing. When you start something, you better have clearly in your head how it's going to end, or you're in trouble. Just like, for example, we did start, we not only boycotted the Olympics, but we also put on the grain embargo.
Certain individuals on the opposite, if either one of the party doesn't speak the language, and you have to work through an interpreter.
First, let me say that though I think a personal rapport is useful, since you're going to be with the people for a long period of time, you might as well have a personal rapport. And you conceivably can pick up a few things. I do think it's possible to run a negotiation without a personal rapport. I don't know that it gives you all that much. It potentially can give you if you can pick it up. Now, it's harder to do if you don't know the language. But it's possible to do. I do not know the Russian language. Fortunately, in Madrid, enough people on the Soviet delegation knew the language. But they had three different heads of their delegation in Madrid. I was there all the time. I mean, I was there during all three of them. During the preparatory meeting, they had their ambassador to Spain head up their delegation. The man who now happens to be the ambassador to Washington, Yuri Dubinin, was their ambassador to Spain. He headed up the delegation. He had been involved in the writing of the Helsinki Final Act, so he knew a lot about it. He spoke no English. He
He now is very good in English, but he knew no English. He expected to be the head of the delegation throughout the meeting. He wasn't. He wasn't, frankly, because he fell flat on his face. And he took a licking in the preparatory meeting. So they replaced him with this Ilyuchev man I told you about, deputy foreign minister, knew no English. And then they replaced Ilyuchev with Kovalyov, another deputy foreign minister who knew no English. Nevertheless, putting Dubinin aside, with whom I never could develop a personal relationship, we didn't develop a personal relationship until he came to Washington. Now he's all smiles and we have a good personal relationship. And we do. I don't mean to denigrate it. But the other two I managed to maintain a good relationship with. It's harder. That's all I can say.
You don't get their personal opinion side sort of.
You don't. You don't get it side sort of like you do if they speak English. You're right. You are right. But you can develop. You can develop a relationship, but not as good as if you know the language. I mean, I could talk with Kwiatkowski about the Union of Concerned Scientists. Well, let me give you an example. Kwiatkowski is a very good example. The first few times I had lunch with him, he had an interpreter present, even though I knew he knew English thoroughly. And I didn't bring an interpreter with me. And at the end of the second meeting, I took him and I said to him, I said, look, you're not talking to me at these luncheons. You're talking to that piece of paper over there. You're talking to your interpreter. I said, we can't. It makes no sense for us to do this. I'm wasting my time. Because I want to talk to you. I want you to talk to me. I don't want you to talk to Moscow. You're careful now that this fellow who's going to cable everything you said. You know English. You want to talk to me, then you and I talk together. Otherwise, let's not do it. I said, if you can't do it, I understand that. Maybe your government doesn't want you to talk to me alone. That's fine. Well, we never again had an interpreter. You see? And you're right. You can do these side things.
The interpreters come from the Pedagogical Institute, and they also have an ancillary function in all these things.
They do. And they also report back everything that they write.
Right.
And that is inhibiting.
Question from a friendly competitor from partner of McGuire Woods in Battle.
Thank you for the plug. Given your statement of the principle of Soviet negotiations as waiting the opponent out and the thoroughness that they will study issues and the perceived notion of the monolithic nature of the Soviet government, it's intriguing to have Gorbachev come on the scene where these dramatic new ideas are rolling off from Moscow almost on a weekly basis. Obviously, he's not participating in the negotiating process, so that may not be changing, but what impact is there in having a new leader who seems to be putting out these innovative ideas so rapidly in terms of the negotiations that are ongoing?
It's a good question and permits me to complete the circle, which, because there are some changes that he has instilled. He is impatient with negotiating processes. He has indeed been rude to his negotiators. He doesn't understand why it takes so long. That's quite different. I don't think these people ever had that kind of an experience with Gromyko. They brought in January of 87, a new counterpart to me. And again, a deputy foreign minister. First deputy foreign minister, a man by the name of Vorontsov, who had lots of other things to do. I met him on January 15th, 1987. We
met each other. He very candidly said to me, we had lunch together, and he said, look, I've got other things to do. I'm handling the Gulf, and I'm handling Afghanistan. You can see that's a big agenda, which of course I recognize. But he said, my government has asked me to come here to see what I can do about getting these negotiations moving. And what suggestions do you have? Very good business-like approach. I told him what suggestions I had. And I told him that, as a matter of fact, for a full year, all of 85 and most of 86, I wasn't even quite sure they were serious negotiators, which was accurate. I told him suggestions that I had made that had been turned down. He accepted every one of them that day at lunch. We called the rest of the negotiating team together for the next day and laid it out. Now, as of that time, I was going to be the counselor to the State Department, with the arms being one of my responsibilities. And he told me he could only be in Geneva maybe 4 or 5 times a year, although he said, I'll be here as often as need be. And I said to him, look, I too am in this position. I have to be in Washington most of the time. Let's just agree we both get back here periodically and both get back here at the same time, which we did. I think we got back 5 or 6 times during the course of the year. We took inventory of what was happening during the course of our absence, tried to overcome some things and push things through a little bit further. Gorbachev has injected that. When there were meetings to take place between either Reagan and Gorbachev or Schultz and Shevardnadze, there was great pressure on the Soviet negotiators to have something to show. Soviets, at the conclusion of a meeting of a high level, like to have a statement come out of it, showing movement. And so this pressure was there to move a little faster. They frequently miscalculate. Now, Vorontsov left at the end of 87. Afghanistan heated up, and it left. And they retreated somewhat to their old patterns. Somewhat, not fully, to their old patterns. Miscalculation, let me use Madrid as an example of miscalculation on where patience can hurt you, can hurt them as it hurt them. They were very eager to have the Madrid meeting come up with an agreement to hold another meeting between the 35 countries on military confidence building measures, which they called a meeting on disarmament. Now, we had accepted the French idea for such a meeting as well. The first decision made by Ronald Reagan as president was to support that French idea, which was a turning point, because when Ronald Reagan became president, none of us really knew how he was going to feel toward NATO or toward our allies. And this was a pro-NATO decision. And I think the fact that Al Haig was Secretary of State at that point is what helped immensely in that move, because that was the pressure on him, and he went along with it. Now, why did they want this meeting? I feel. Never really quite sure. But why did they want this meeting? They were desperately trying to stop us from deploying the Pershings and cruise missiles in the mainland of Europe. And they knew this was a hot political potato for the Germans, and the Belgians, and the Norwegians, and the Danes, and the Brits. They knew that, not the French. They knew that. And they felt that if out of Madrid would come an agreement to have what they would call a meeting on disarmament, even though it was a meeting on confidence building process, that this would permit them to go to the publics in Europe and say, why are you putting in more American missiles which is confrontational, at a time when we've now agreed to hold a meeting on disarmament. Clever move on that part. Now, I knew this, and so frankly, I was not in a hurry. When I took this job, I asked Cy Vance how long I would be in the job, and he said 3-4 months. It lasted 3 years. But the fact of the matter is, if there was going to be an agreement, in my lights, I was not that much in a hurry, although it was going to take a long time, I knew. But they were not. They stalled and stalled and stalled. And by the time they finally came to terms, which meant agreeing with us, which they did, the die was cast on the Persians and cruise missiles. They no longer could stop it. That's miscalculation. I think had they made the concessions they made at the end, had they made it halfway through, I would have been in a position of saying, how could I not take the concessions?
Mr. Ambassador, the question we've asked everybody in the Reagan oral history has been, were the institutional relationships about right, as you saw them, were your relations with the Secretary the right kind of relationships? Did you have access to the President? Did you get support for your negotiating positions, as apparently Paul did not on the walk in the woods, or did he?
You have to understand that I was not on the scene during the walk on the woods. I didn't enter the scene, the disarmament scene, until 1985. I was in Madrid while Paul was talking INF and included the walk in the woods, and as a matter of fact, Paul and I both went to Bonn, I from Madrid, he from Geneva, to brief Chancellor Kohl on both of these negotiations at the same time, so I had a chance to talk to Paul and see where he was going. I'll speak only for myself, not for Paul. I could not have had more access or better access than I had in Madrid and in Geneva. I had absolutely nothing to complain about in those areas. Madrid access with Carter was clear, but it was only a few months. The Madrid access with Reagan was somewhat accidental. I was at a conference on armaments in Munich. In the audience, when the head of the conference asked me if I would be willing to come up front and talk about the Madrid meeting, because he recognized that I was there. And I did. Present in the audience, and I did not know, was the new National Security Advisor, Judge Clark. At the end of my talk, I went back to the rear, sat in my seat, and he came over to me. I'd never met him. And he said, have you ever had a chance to discuss this with President Reagan? I said, no. Now, you got to remember, he was new. This was early in the Reagan administration also. It was right after Dick Allen left. Well, he said, I'd like you to talk to the President about this. I think the President should hear what you've had to say. I said, I'd be delighted. So he arranged that meeting. That meeting turned out to be a total seminar in the Oval Office. President and Vice President Bush, Meese, Baker, Deaver, really the top people, that Clark, McFarlane as deputy. And we must have spent an hour and a half talking about the Madrid meeting, talking about the Soviets. That, of course, opened up a lot of doors as far as the President was concerned. And I did have perhaps 3 or 4 additional experiences with the President during the Madrid meeting. I mean, for example, at one point, I'm thinking now about what would be useful to your study. That's how I'm answering. At one point, I felt we would get an agreement. I didn't know how long it would take, but I felt the Soviets were going to give us what we needed. Might be, let's say, a year and a half before the meeting was over. I just sensed that. And by then, Schultz was the Secretary. And I said to Schultz, I said, look, I think we've got to get an agreement. Does the president want an agreement? Good question. He'd never had an agreement with the Soviets before. I knew his attitude on this thing. Schultz said, well, haven't you ever asked them? I said, no, never quite in those words. Well, he said, didn't you see him last week? I said, yes, I did see him last week, but there were other people in the room, and I just didn't feel I wanted to ask him with other people in the room. So he said, well, let's find out. He picked up the phone. Within a few minutes, we were over at the White House. He said, Mr. President, Max has a question to ask you. I asked him a question. I got the answer. Sure, I want to answer. If it's our agreement, if it's an agreement in our interest, one you're prepared, you and George are prepared to recommend, sure, one. You see? It's that kind of thing. I mean, at one point, I was dissatisfied with our position, which I had formulated. I want to say in Madrid, I wrote all the instructions for me. You have to understand that Washington did not think anything would come out of Madrid. The result is nobody paid any attention to what I was doing. I wrote my instructions. People knew me. I had a lot of friends. You know, I've been in Washington a long time. Had confidence in me. Nobody thought an agreement would come out of Madrid. And so, let Max do what he wants to do. Well, at one point, when I, this is after the meeting of, do you want an agreement, Mr. President, I began to feel that what we were asking for from the Soviets was not enough. For me, it was not enough. We were asking for them to agree to certain important words, which were important. But I wanted some people out of the Soviet Union. At that point, I just was sufficiently irritated with the system, irritated with the Soviets, fed up with the increasing inhumanity that was developing, that I simply wanted. I wanted them to say uncle, if I can use that word. And that meant I wanted people out of them. This was not the position we'd arrived at with NATO when we started the Madrid meeting. But you have to remember, when we started the Madrid meeting, it was based on an assumption that the rest of the West wasn't even certain we should be emphasizing human rights as much as we were emphasizing. There was a previous meeting in Belgrade at which the United States was the only country to mention the names of the victims of Soviet repression. And the United States mentioned six names. Let me tell you, that was the U.S. the only country. That was just 3 years later, Madrid opened. I want to tell you, by the end of the Madrid meeting, I think it was 18 or 19 countries mentioned the names of the victims, which they had refused to do 3 years earlier, and I think more than 200, 250 names were mentioned, rather than the six. So there was a lot of movement in the human rights area. It was a united NATO group, but now I felt, so I mentioned this to George Shultz, and I said I was simply uncomfortable with it, personally. And he said, well, we got to ask the president. And incidentally, I want to say to you, you're doing the Reagan papers. As far as George Shultz was concerned, it was constantly, I've got to go talk to the president. And if anybody misses that point, it's a mistake. And this, and I, as you know, as counselor to the department, I met with George Shultz. There were four of us that met. It was John Whitehead, Mike Armacost, and myself, and the secretary, every single day on any issue. And it was constantly, get a paper for me, got to take this up with the president. You see? So in this case, we got to take the president. So I went to the president, talked to the president, and told the president what I felt we had to do to change our position. I also told him that none of our allies would be in favor of it. He said, you have to tell him. I said, well, I don't have to tell him that baldly, but I certainly have to tell you. and I got to know whether you're going to support me on this. And there was no hesitation about it. To give you an example of that, you see, no hesitation about it. And then sure enough, when the Germans began to suspect, Chancellor Kohl got on the telephone, called Ronald Reagan, complained over the fact that I seemed to be exceeding the requests of the Soviets. And I'm told by people who took notes, because Kohl doesn't speak English, and Reagan didn't speak German, so we had people on the phone taking the notes, and I saw the notes, and Reagan was great about it. I'll add a footnote here that at the conclusion of the Madrid meeting, Kohl and Genscher gave me a medal.
The other two questions we've asked everybody, and one you may not want to discuss, but what were the obstacles? We're going to have Richard Pearl here on September the 21st, and the media has played up the divisions between defense and state, particularly in the Weinberger era, and naturally that's one issue that we hope to get into. The other question is, what was your impression of the president? We've asked this in each of the oral histories. What was your impression of the president as a political leader at your first meeting, and did you modify that view in any way as you went along, and what do you think history's judgment is going to be of this president?
Let me answer them in turn. Our interagency process is a necessary process, but it's a cumbersome process. It's particularly cumbersome when one of the important agencies is skeptical about the results and wonders whether there should be any result at all. In my opinion, Cap Weinberger probably did not wish to have an arms reduction agreement. I haven't the slightest doubt in my mind that Ronald Reagan did. And Cap was a loyal cabinet member. So he was going to go along with what the president wanted. But you could see with that mindset that he couldn't conceive of an agreement really that was in the U.S. interest. He felt that he could persuade the president when the time came that the agreement being talked about was not in the U.S. interest, and therefore he could handle it. And that created lots of delays in our ability to come up with a U.S. position. So if you ask me what was the greatest problem, I would say that was. On the other hand, would I change the interagency system? Not a bit. I had an interagency system in Geneva. We had three negotiations running simultaneously. INF, START, SPACE. I was the head of the overall, and I handled SPACE. Each one of these three negotiating groups had representatives from five government agencies on it as members. State Department, Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the Intelligence Agency. So you had, and not counting the NSC, the White House, which was always present in all of these things, though not formally a delegate. So you see what a large group we had in each one. And we had our own interagency group. And I insisted on that. That is, I insisted, but they insisted themselves. They wanted president. We talked out these things among ourselves, you see. Now, let me say to you that you have Richard Pearl coming up here. I do not believe, and I can only speak personally, I would not say the same thing about Richard Pearl that I've just said about Cap. I believe Richard Pearl was prepared to have an arms agreement. I don't believe Cap was. Now, Richard may tell you, no, Cap wanted one too, but it had to be in the interest. But I don't think so. I've talked enough with Cap. Let me also say about Richard Pearl. When I got an agreement together in Madrid, and as I indicated to you, nobody expected it, and the State Department saw there was an agreement, we then had to go to defense to get approval, moving along. And the people in the State Department said, defense won't accept the agreement. They don't want an agreement. And I knew the decision maker for the Madrid meeting was Richard Pearl. So I said, well, talk to them. Well, no, we're not going to talk to them. Which was a foolish kind of thing. The particular head I talked to, a very senior official of the State Department, he says, you talk to them. So I said, all right, I'll go see Richard. So I went to see Richard. It was on a Sunday. I dropped by his home. We talked about it. Explained it. Said, Richard, and Richard said, Max, you think it's a good agreement? I said, it's a good agreement, Dick. He said, so let's go for it. Just like that. He had confidence in me. He knew what we were doing. Did it. We had no conflict in it. We had the agreement. Richard's, now let me just say something about Richard exaggerating my statement. First, let me tell you why I think Richard wanted an arms agreement. A, he wanted an arms agreement that he was in control of. By that I mean that he knew the provisions of. Because he knows that he isn't going to sell out the United States. He's really not sure about the next guy. Particularly if the next guy's in the State Department. But he knows that he will not sell out the United States. Now, he and I used to talk about this. He saw an agreement under Ronald Reagan as a very impressive opportunity to have worldwide political implications. For Ronald Reagan, evil empire, strong defense, to make the moves toward peace and to achieve something that nobody else could achieve would in effect repudiate growing pacifism in the churches, growing pacifism in the leftist political parties. None of them could achieve anything. Would strengthen the Thatchers and the Coles of this world, because the conservatives could say, we are the true peacemakers. We are negotiating from strength. You've got to have strength to negotiate. We're negotiating from firmness. You've got to be firm. You've got to understand the nature of the adversary. Tremendous political kind of a thrust to it. Richard understood that. And this is a reason why. Let me give you an illustration, another illustration. John Warner of this date and Sam Nunn came up with an idea of nuclear risk reduction centers. I want to, in the candor of this room, say to you, I still do not understand what nuclear risk reduction centers, how they're going to work, other than it's a tremendous name to risk reduction. Tremendous thing. I always used to feel the fellow who developed the concept of an excess profits tax is a genius. Nobody can be against an excess profits tax. Well, a risk reduction center has much of the same thing. And I attended many meetings at the White House when we were trying to figure out what the hell is this nuclear risk reduction center? And what did John and Sam have in mind with it? But they had it in mind. And obviously, given the power these two people had in the Senate Armed Services Committee, nobody was going to be against it. And they were both going to visit Gorbachev, to go to Moscow. And they said, how would you feel if we were going to take this up with Gorbachev? Everybody said, of course, take it up with Gorbachev. Maybe he'll kill it. They took it up with Gorbachev. And Gorbachev enthusiastically thought it was great. We later heard from the Soviets, Gorbachev didn't quite understand what was meant by your two senators. Would you tell us what they had in mind? Anyhow, agreement was made to negotiate nuclear risk reduction center. And I was with Sam and John in Geneva. They both came. They both, I want to say, very serious, careful observers of our negotiations. And both were in Geneva many times. And one of their spots, they were both as angry as can be. And they took me aside and they said, Max, we're just very upset. What do you advise us? And I said, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that the person chosen to negotiate the nuclear risk reduction for the United States is Dick Pearl. And you know he's going to kill it. And I said, and I think they were both surprised, that's the best thing that could happen to you fellows, is to have Dick Pearl negotiate this treaty. Because he'll produce it. Because he knows that what he comes up with will be good for the country. So don't be concerned about it. If somebody else were negotiating this, Dick would be against it. Well, you know, that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And the Soviets, who thought of Richard Pearl as some black demon someplace, came over to me at the conclusion of very brief negotiations, it didn't take long, to say how impressed they were with Richard. Isn't it interesting? So anyhow, that's a long answer to your first question on the interagency process. I do want to say, however, there's another obstacle to the negotiations, which is that the United States simply still does not have a policy on Mobile, still does not have We do not still have agreement on a land-based missile. The fight between the MX and the Midgeton, or alternatives or options between them or none of them is still not resolved, and that is a barrier. At one point, somebody said to the president in my presence, Mr. President, the Soviets came to you tomorrow. Gorbachev came to you tomorrow. I said, okay, got a lot done. Got a few things left. You write the treaty and I'll sign it. Mr. President, we still couldn't write the treaty. That's part of our problem. There are still some questions. They're fewer in number now, and we're working them out. But we don't have everything yet in the hand. That's obviously a handicap. Now, your other question has to do with my perception of the president. I don't know that I can see a difference between the president the first time I met him, the president the last time I met him, because the first time I met him in office was the seminar I talked to you about, which was a rather positive experience. It was an extraordinarily good meeting, and he participated. He listened more than he spoke, but he participated. He was actively involved in it. I
I have always found him attentive and responsive. Have I ever seen him nodding off? Yes. I will confess to you that I have nodded off. I remember being at a meeting in NATO after Moscow with George Shultz reporting, and I kept awake while he was reporting. I was sitting right in the front row, back of him. I kept awake while he was reporting. He finished reporting, and then all the other 15 had to make some comments. And I just kept coming off. I couldn't keep my eyes open. I was tired. It was after a Moscow trip. I stood up and left and came back and still nodded off. Anyhow, yes, I have seen the president nod off. He does not have, in my opinion, a mastery of detail. I am impressed with his instincts. Really impressed with the instincts. And he gets something in his head and it stays with him in his head. We had lots of arguments around the table in his presence on the question of mobile missiles. Lots of discussions. And the differences of the agencies would again be presented to him. First time he listened to this, and he then said, you know, he says, I just want to tell you how I feel about this. He said, let's assume we don't have an agreement on mobiles. Don't have an agreement. Are we going to go ahead and build mobiles? Is the Congress going to give us the money we need for the midget men? Answer is probably no. The Soviets going to continue to build their 25s? Answer is undoubtedly yes. Why is it in our interest not to have an agreement on mobiles, he'd say? They're not going to agree to stop the 25s. Why not have some mutual restraint? Well, it made sense to me. A few months later, we had the argument all over again. He repeated the same argument. Each time when he did this, this was in effect his decision. You see, that is, he had an instinct about these things. It was a political instinct, more than an instinct based on mastery of any of the facts. But the instinct was rather good. In connection with one of our discussions, that discussion I had with him about wanted to get some people out. At the end of it, he walked over to his desk and he opened up a drawer and he took out a sheet of paper and he gave it to me and he said, Max, see if you can get these people out too. I don't know how he got the names, why he had the names. Obviously, it was in his head. So I want to say to you, my general reaction to Reagan, and I speak, you know, as a Democrat, is a very positive one about him. There's an article in the, not the current issue of the National Interest, I don't know if you get the National Interest magazine, current issue just got this week, one previous to this week, by a professor of political science at Berkeley, Aaron Wildowski, on the Reagan presidency. Now, it's a little early to express judgments about how history will resolve anything, but Aaron, at this early stage, and Aaron is also a Democrat, evaluates the Reagan presidency in extremely favorable terms. And I think it's worthwhile for your study to look at Aaron's piece. It's a perceptive piece. I would say one problem with Reagan the Reagan administration was its inability to work as closely with the Congress as I think they should have. I think, for whatever reasons, they simply did not take as much advantage of it as they should have and could have. And I think more would have been accomplished had this thing been better executed.
One or two more questions, and then we'll probably...
Ken, I wonder if I could underline something Max said about the importance of access to the President of the United States. Access means everything.
Briefly, so we get one or two others.
You underlined it. You're right.
I used to brief President Roosevelt twice a day. I had to brief him very sadly one day about the fact that a reporter named Stanley Johnson had broken the news that we had broken the Japanese codes and thus won the Battle of Midway. And he called in the Attorney General immediately. He said, I want to sue him under the espionage statute. Both of them. They hated each other, Colonel McCormick. While that was going on, I had a visitor at the White House from the Navy Chief Codebreaker. He said, Bill, you got to stop this lawsuit. You got to stop it. I said, oh, me? You don't know how the President hates Colonel McCormick. But I had access. And when the President came into Dr. McIntyre's office that day, I told him about this visitor. He said, well, what reason did he give? He said, well, it's close to breaking the Japanese flag officer's code, but if you have a lawsuit against the press, it's going to leak. Well, he said, who was your visitor? And I said, it was the Navy Chief Codebreaker, Captain Safford. He said, you mean Sappho? I know Sappho. He said, you can tell him I'll drop the lawsuit. That's the importance of access. Yes.
Other, Bill Wimple?
Do you foresee the prospect of the Soviet Union becoming deloused, killing off the bugs and knocking down the barriers to people leaving the country, even if they don't decide to let everybody in?
Gorbachev and those who support him know they've got a failed system. It doesn't work. You know, under the Tsar's days, Russia exported food. Today they can't feed their own people. The system is a failure. They know that. Their task is, how do they bring it into a modern era, technologically, economically, commercially? It's a very difficult task. If I have any gifts, one of them I know is not prophecy. So I don't know how to judge this. I know logically they cannot do it. If I were betting, I would say they cannot do it. But I learned a long time ago that politics, including international politics, is not rational and not logical. And they might do it. They might do it. I'm not prepared to bet they won't do it. They've got to do it if they're going to survive as a system. They understand the need to humanize their system now, because they're the pariahs of the world, have been the pariahs of the world. They're in a situation where no people, any place in the world, would voluntarily subject themselves to their system. And they know that. Couldn't have said that 20 years ago. I mean, it's so widespread. Their inhumanity, their failures are so widespread. They know that. This is not a surprise to those who are intelligent about it. So they've got to change the system. They'd like to make as few changes as possible. They look upon themselves as Leninists. We ought not to kid ourselves. They do look upon themselves. They want to make as few changes as possible. They'll make as many as they have to and get away with it. That's Gorbachev's problem. What can he get away with as he makes these changes? Tremendous resistance throughout the system. Really unusual resistance. You have brave, heroic, intellectual leaders saying fantastic things openly. You can speak to some of the maverick young lawyers, not even so young, lawyers, talking about the need to change their legal system. I had one lawyer say to me, we made a mistake when we went to adopt the Roman system. We should have gone to the Anglo-Saxon system. We would then know now how we can move to your system of law. They want to do that. But you know, this man says that. He knows that at the Gorbachev level there is support. But between the Gorbachev level and his level, there's total opposition. Let's take psychiatric hospitals. A group of psychiatrists have just returned from a historic visit to visit, I think they visited 11, I can't remember, or 15 Soviet psychiatric institutions. Institutions they selected. And they made a point of not telling the Soviets which institutions until 1 week ahead of time. So they couldn't scrub them all in time. And you do have a group of younger psychiatrists who've now formed an association. Want to make changes in it. But in between, no. Resistance to the changes. The man who heads up the Ministry of Health, a man, incidentally, who got the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago, a shameful step in my opinion, is one of the fellows refusing to acknowledge the necessity for changes in the political, in the use of psychiatric hospitals for political punishment. Mamdanov Chazov refuses to do it, yet he got a Nobel Peace Prize. He's a fellow who helped put Sakharov away, and he gets the Nobel Peace Prize. When you think about it, you know, the outrage of it. But you see, so you've got this dichotomy between resistance, top level, heroic people down below who want to change it, and the difference. I don't know if it'll work or not. My own opinion is that it's in our interest if it does work.
I think this is one discussion which could well be continued until dusk this evening, and then some. Those of us who remember from earlier days the excitement of the group around Senator Hubert Humphrey and at his right hand Max Kampelman haven't been a bit surprised by the intellectual political excitement of the discussion today, and one could just hope and pray that somebody like Max Kampelman will occupy the position he's been occupying for the last 9 years. Ever so thankful to you for coming.
Thank you.